Now it's time for Homegrown on 94.7 WPBC LP Charlottesville with your hosts, Clinton Johnston and Leslie M. Scott Jones, Charlottesville's only radio show devoted to local arts. And now...
Good morning, Sunday morning. Whether you're an art maker, an art breaker, an art faker, or an art partaker, welcome all, because of course all are welcome to Homegrown, your show about local art. I'm the one that they call Clinton, and I'm here with the wizardess of the airwaves, the sorceress of sound, Leslie M. Scott Jones.
Good morning, Clinton. Oh, you're calling me magic today. Thank you.
I'm calling you a magic user today. A user of arcane talents.
Yes, I am. All the time.
All the time.
Every day.
Every day. How are you this morning, Leslie?
I'm really good, actually. We had like an awesome show last night.
Did ya?
Yeah. You know, it's so great when the audience is like in there with you. When they are just they're just there with you and they come along with the story. You wouldn't know that?
No, I've heard about that. I've heard about that. Usually for my audiences, for my shows, we have to sneak in like a little bit of speed into their coffee and into their water bottles just to keep them a little, you know, awake, you know, just to give them a little lively.
No.
We also anchor their ankles to the chairs to keep them from getting up and leaving.
No, we didn't.
They're that way.
Oh, okay.
We always play to captive audiences.
Wow. Okay. No, we captivated them with our art.
Get out.
We did. It was awesome.
How old school of you.
I know. But it was fun. We had a great show last night. So nice. I'm in a great mood today.
Well, awesome. Awesome. Nice to hear. Well, I think that I can't think of a segue, so I'm just going to go right into our parental advisory. We're going to start the show with a parental advisory, which we frequently do. So we're out here to advise all parentals. At one point in the show, we may, it's possible, it's certainly a possibility, but we'll fight against it. With all the faith and fervor of the truly righteous, we may say the word preponderance. Preponderance. But you know, we'll try not to. It'll be hard. So, but if you've got young ones, if you've got teeny tiny ones, and you don't want to have to explain to them what they can do with their preponderance of things, then you might want to send them out. This show might be too much for them. It might just be too much.
It's too much for a lot of people a lot of the time.
We try to have it be just enough.
I know. And every once, we just go over, you know, just a little bit.
Speaking of going over, it's a morning of lame segues. It's the lame, welcome to the lame segue morning of Homegrown, your show about local art. We're just going to turn, you know what we need? We need the car screeching sound for when there's no segue. Just a...
Okay, so that means...
Next topic.
So now we need a mic drop and we need a
mic drop.
And a car screech. Okay.
Eventually, right. We'll turn this into a wacky morning wake-up show.
You mean it's not now?
I don't think it's officially the wacky morning wake-up show until you get the air horn.
Oh, okay. All right. I don't know if I can deal with the air horn.
I really don't know if I can deal with the air horn.
All right. Who's our first guest today?
I can deal with them. Our first guest today... We've got a gentleman here. He is an artist and an artistic journalist. He's here, and he is also here with our man, Brian Weimer, executive director of the XR Park. Welcome, Larry Gerritsen.
Hey, Clinton. How are you guys doing today? Leslie, good to see you. Thanks for having me on.
He's so nice.
He is.
I just love... He's so sweet.
You're just used to me.
Yeah, I want to start polite, and we'll get to it later.
Oh, all righty. So, Larry, you wrote an article that appeared in Seaville Weekly.
It was the cover article of last week's
Seaville Weekly, about the disappearance of affordable studio space in Charlottesville. So, so what prompted you to write the article?
Yeah, well, I've been involved in... kind of sometimes rather kind of full bore and at other times kind of peripherally in theater in Charlottesville for a long, long time. And I've been writing for Seville for the last few years now, and I've been very interested in telling stories around the whole effort that is coming right now to redevelop the south side of downtown Charlottesville, what the city calls the strategic investment area. And it strikes me that that's about the last...
Which the city calls the strategic investment area. Don't the rest of us just call it the whole bunch of black people area?
Yeah, it's partly the whole bunch of black people area, but it's also, it's more than that. It's the little worker bungalow housing area where the ex-factory workers back in the 1940s had their little homes, which is one of my favorite little nooks in Charlottesville. These little square bungalows where working class folk were able to live right next to where they worked and walk to work every day. I mean, it's a great little part of town. There's backyard radiator shops still in that part of town. There are little corner grocery stores still in that little part of town. And the story of the strategic investment in our area is that development, redevelopment, and in particular upscaling is going to happen in that part of town. It's the last unredeveloped part of downtown Charlottesville. So I've been for a couple of years now looking for stories there. And like I said, I've been involved in the arts. And for me, one of the interesting things about having an unredeveloped part of downtown Charlottesville like that is that it provides lots of opportunity for pioneer creative types to come in and start to build grassroots, creative, cultural, social, artistic, homegrown stuff in those neighborhoods. So I think we're running out of space for that in Charlottesville. The SIA is the last bit of that space that's still available. So I went around in this article and kind of took a little census of what's going on there. And what I found was, artists kind of camped out in little nooks and crannies of unredeveloped old post-industrial buildings. I found lots going on at the Ix Art Park that takes advantage of the fact that there's a big wonkin' space there that hasn't been redeveloped yet.
Right.
And the only reason that that can be there is that somebody hasn't scooped it up and started dropping another 9-story mixed-use, upscale, retail on the bottom, offices and condos up top building. Those buildings are happening all over the place, and I don't think we're the better for it. So I'll stop talking now, but that's the setup.
Well, that leads perfectly into my next question is why, as artists, we know why that protecting that sort of space is important, but why did, obviously you wrote the article because you had a very specific reason about why keeping that space is important. What does it add to Charlottesville?
Yeah. So the subtitle of the article is the value of unredeveloped space in Charlottesville. And what's the value? So what do we know about what happens when the economy shifts and a place that used to have warehouses and industrial space goes vacant? One of the things we know about it is that it tends to get colonized by creative types who are looking for cheap elbow room places to work. And it's the classic story of a place like that probably many people are aware of, like Soho in New York, right? I mean, used to be on all those buildings that are south of Houston Street in New York used to be, shirt factories and, tool and dye manufacturers and stuff like that. And when the manufacturing base goes away, the industrial base goes away, all that stuff sits fallow and empty. And what happens? Creative types populate it. Why? Because they need a place to work. It's the Virginia Woolf, a room of one's own kind of thing. You're not necessarily making a ton of money as a pioneering artist, so you need a place that's cheap. And you need a place that hasn't been kind of maybe dressed up and fitted out with all the good,
all the amenities.
Infrastructures and amenities, thanks. And you need a place that's kind of a blank slate. And we're running out of those places in Charlottesville. Yeah,
I think that's something that a lot of people who were not involved in the arts think about or know about. And I think that it's something that one of my joys in doing this show, because Leslie and I both come from a theater background, like you do, and one of the joys in doing the show is to see what things go across different genres of art, and what things are unique to the particular genres of art. And I think this is one of the things that does go across the particular genres of art. I remember there, and that is the need for space and a particular type of space for rehearsal, for the creation of the art for making it. I remember some years ago, Leslie and I were doing a production together, and we were looking and we needed a space to rehearse it, to build it. And fortunately, a friend of mine owned a business that was unused in the evening and had a loading dock sort of area. And he said, well, what kind of space do you need? And I said, all I need is an open space where we're not going to be able to break anything and where we can be loud, right? Where we can run around and shout and scream and it's not going to bother anyone.
And that's not every space. I mean, that's not, there's only certain types of spaces work for those kinds of needs. And it's as true, I think you're right, it's as true of musicians as it is of theater artists. It's as true of painters. You think about the studios at McGuffey, you walk into one of those, right? And they are plastered with little trial runs, little, you know, ideas boards, the original Pinterest is just, you know, stick it on the wall, right? And and use it for inspiration to come back to it. In theater history, there's a great book that was written 40, 50 years ago. What is it? Peter Brook, The Empty Space, right? Mm-hmm. He talks about the first sentence of that book is something like, a man walks through an empty room, an audience watches, that is an act of theater. Right?
Yeah.
There's something, when you get right down to it, there's something really elemental and liberating about that quality of emptiness. And artists tap into that all the time. It's a fundamental need that they have.
Yeah, and we've had a couple artists that have studios at McGuffey. Russell Richards, when he was on the show, he talked about how it's really cool that he's in his studio, but he has music playing from downstairs, from like drum circles or dance classes or whatever is going on downstairs. And it actually feeds what he's doing and being in a space that other artists can also create has helped him, you know, transform his art and it's influenced it. And, you know, without that space, who knows what he would be doing now? You know, who knows if he would still be drawing? Like, it's, you know, we need those kind of spaces. So how has the article gotten any backlash? What's the response been?
Yeah, it's been light. there have been a couple of very favorable posts on Facebook. I just heard recently, just today, in fact, that one of the developers that's written about in this article had a kind of a negative reaction to it. I don't know the content of that negative reaction. You know, summertime in Charlottesville has not traditionally been a time when you can get a lot of people paying attention to a print piece like this. So that's why I'm really happy to be here today to be getting a little more focus on the issue. I've got another piece coming up at the end of the summer, still in the summer, unfortunately, but at the end of the summer about economic redevelopment within the SIA, and I'll be looking for some feedback about that as well. Part of what I wanted to do with this is kind of drop a little bomb on the city and kind of the powers that be there, and to say that you guys have not been thinking about this. And I talked to the economic director of development of the city, Alex Ikafuna, who's an interesting guy and who sees the value of some place like the Ix Art Park in the future of the SIA. But I asked him point up, you know, what have you guys done to help secure the future of the Ix Art Park?
Right.
And he said, nothing. Nothing. So, you know, I would say bring Brian in now because...
Yeah, so Brian, what do you... Because you're mentioned in the article, and which was one of the reasons you're here, and you're smack dab in that zone. What are your thoughts about that?
I think one of the key things with this issue, it's called a strategic investment area. I think the key part of that is strategic because... A lot of the development in this city that's been happening lately seems to me a bit haphazard, a bit fast, a bit unplanned, and it's kind of like the ship of industry will keep kind of cranking through down West Main and everywhere else, and it depends what is that strategy. I mean, I think a key part of strategy is what is your goal? Is
right.
The goal revenue?
So like they don't have a goal. They just want it to look pretty.
No, I think that they have a goal. I don't know if that goal is just purely economic. And you could say, well, who doesn't want economic goals? But is it just about money? But I think there's a huge other element that we value in Charlottesville, and that's quality of living. And that, it's hard to put a price tag on what it's like to go eat at Blue Moon Diner.
Yeah.
Or the experience that people had at places like Random Row Books.
Right.
And even what we're doing at Ix, which is hard to quantify. And I kind of like that you can't calibrate it. But people have an experience there that they don't have other places. Like, you can go to Stonefield and you can go get chocolate-covered stuff at Trader Joe's, but it's not a connection to your community. It will satisfy you for a moment, and then you will forget what that experience was. But people have experiences at Ix now that change their lives. There are communities that are being formed. This weekend, we had a fundraiser for the fire-damaged businesses on the downtown mall, Ike's Underground, Tea Bazaar, and Miso Sweet. And there were a bunch of people who got together and had conversations and talking about how do we come together. That doesn't happen a lot of other places. So within that strategy, to me, the focus is how do you create community? I think economics and revenue are important. So what is the goal of this strategy in this area? And then you say, what is the plan? And you guys have been saying this word a couple times, and that's creating. Now, creating is not just taking bricks and stacking them up. That can be a form of creation, but to me, the center of it is creativity, and creativity is imagination. And I think that the city has to have more imagination when it creates new spaces. And that's what we're doing, I hope, at Ix, most of all, is to say, how do we use creativity strategically to create community?
Hi, this is Jason Burke of the Six Pack Songwriter Series. You're listening to 94.7 FM, Homegrown.
18 minutes past the hour. If you're just joining us, welcome. We're here with Larry Garrettson, local artist and local artistic writer. I like art journalist.
Hey, thanks. Yeah, I like that too.
There you go. And Brian Weimer, executive director of the Ix Art Park, talking about development. And development working maybe, dare we say, against the interests of artists in their search for undeveloped and cheap and useful spaces for them to work and practice their art, and specifically the strategic investment area downtown. Larry, you're going to jump in.
Brian was talking about creativity and the social value of the creativity. And another facet of this is that social and cultural entrepreneurs that kind of generate kind of nonprofit action that works in the community to help foster community. And there are a couple of them that I'd love to highlight in the SIA that are in danger if this upscaling happens of having their rents kind of jacked up beyond their ability to sustain. And it's the Urban Agriculture Collective that I read about in this article.
Right.
Bikes is right there in these little unredeveloped garage spaces, and the Bridge PAI, Progressive Arts Institute. The Bridge is an artistic organization, but Urban Agriculture Collective and Charlottesville Bikes are not. But they're social and they're cultural entrepreneurs. They're doing community building, and they're as dependent as artists are on cheap spaces to help them ramp up and get a toehold in the community, so they can do the work that they do of making our community stronger.
Yeah, the thing that strikes me so strongly when talking about this and hearing about this is that this seems to be that this is a very, very old discussion. And this is something that really strikes to some of the core conflicts or core questions about how we run Western culture, right? I mean, the phrase that keeps going through my head is a phrase from Douglas Adams' Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, where he makes a joke about galactic economists writing smug treatises or over the benefits of a planned economy, right? But it goes back farther than that. It's like, well, you know, it's the struggle between, or isn't it? Isn't it the struggle between a group that's saying, well, you know what? we need to allow for business entrepreneurs, for business interests, be able to move and develop and to progress without being hampered, so that we can pursue the profit motive, which is what drives us and which is what drives the country. And another group saying, well, that can't be the only thing that does so. That can't be the only guide that we use. To let things go willy-nilly like that means that we lose some things, and lose some things that are important for the thriving of a healthy community. Perhaps we should decide what goes where, which goes what goes that. And it's like, this is really central. And I wonder how much, especially in our current world, which prioritizes the profit motive so much. I wonder if arts are on the losing side of that. Cause I've had friends who have said to me, you know, who were completely against, donations to arts, and who've said, you know, why, if your art can't survive based on what it makes, if you can't market it, if you can't sell it, if there's not an audience for it, if you can't compete in this current economic situation, then it'll be unfortunate, but it should die, because that's the way things work.
One element, I had the pleasure of helping with the Tom Tom Festival this year, and I kind of saw it from beginning to end. And I had some misgivings about it originally, but I really have a great respect for it now. One of the things was sort of blending this notion of innovation and arts and creativity. And it was very heavy on the innovation side, but, you know, it's sponsored by Darden and stuff, and, you know, they're going to look into the hardcore economics. But I think one of the things that everybody came back to was that the people coming from Silicon Valley and stuff like that to come here are coming here for a quality of life. And it's something that started in other places. San Francisco had that before, but now it's too expensive to live there. And that's sort of one of the caveats and dangers of becoming too popular. But that the arts lead the way. The arts go, they find spaces that before were not as vitalized, perhaps unsafe, whatever, and they go in, and it's the frontier, and they go and they try to find ways to use resources and be resourceful and make it interesting. And it's, again, back to that creativity, but it's a dance. And you said the word struggle, and I would like this to be not a struggle between developers and artists, but a partnership, because we're on the same team. We all want the same things here. And let's dance together, and let's make creativity the center of how we reimagine this strategy in this area. And it is about open spaces, but it is also about development. So how do we get the right kind of development in places, an intentional development? And it might have to be a little denser in some parts and a little bit more open in others. And it'll have to be mixed. And it'll have to have many uses. But that's where we have to kind of look to new paradigms. How are we going to live, not today, not in the last decade, but in the next 20 to 100 years? What's that going to look like? Is that going to have bicycles? Is it going to have walking paths? Is it going to have public theaters? Is it going to have apartments above and below? Is it going to have urban agriculture with farms? But those are the models, and that's creativity, and that takes risks. That's like the downtown mall. I'm going to brick Main Street. Who's with me? Really?
Yeah.
But this is where creatives go. Because we're kind of crazy, and we can imagine a possibility of how we might live or be, and that's how we experiment with theater. We reimagine, you know, periods of history. How would they have been if this had happened? So we're the ones who ask a lot of the what ifs, and then it's to partner with the people who have the resources to make those what ifs manifest.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like, it's the same as scientific research. You know, the government they give money to scientific research because they know that it will benefit the greater good, but they do not put huge caveats on how the research is conducted, because they know that if you start an experiment to find one answer, you could, in the course of that research, find answers to three other things that you weren't even looking for. And I think that's the kind of perspective that we need to make sure that the city and the developers have. It's like, you know, you don't know the outcome of this. You have no idea what this space could come from it. You know, you have no idea. And you have to allow for that to happen.
If it happens organically,
yeah,
what's going to come of it is good. And, you know, so we have a sterling example, and Brian just mentioned it, right here in the city, of how to make this work. It's the downtown mall.
Right.
How did it work? So I did a piece about the early sort of creative pioneers on the downtown mall a year ago, which just really kind of put in my head the idea of this thing in the SIA. And I had a chance to talk to Bill Lucy, who was the head of the urban planning division at UVA for a long time. He just died a couple of months ago. Unfortunately, a great guy. But he's lived downtown his whole professional life and has studied the success of the downtown mall. He put in my head the key to the success of the downtown mall. He said the city decided it was going to play small ball. Small ball is a little phrase from baseball, right? It says you're going to win by doing the small things.
You get
a bunt here, a double play there, and you end up winning 3-2. Well, small ball in the downtown mall means they didn't build a stadium downtown to try and redevelop downtown.
Right.
They didn't drop a whole bunch of 9-story brand new, big, upscale buildings on the place. They let it develop organically. Large number of storefronts right next to each other, a seed bed for creative stuff percolating up. And that's the good kind of economic development. That's the kind of economic development that comes from the grassroots, and it creates a scene like it did on the downtown mall. And creative entrepreneurs were absolutely essential to creating a scene on the downtown mall. The fact that that scene was allowed to develop is the basis of the success of the downtown mall. And we got to do that in the SIA.
It's the basis of the popularity of Charlottesville too. I mean, I have friends that live in DC, in Philadelphia, in, you know, Chicago, and when they come visit, they're like, "Oh, we got to go to the downtown mall. That's what we got to do. That's the place." You know, I mean, come on. You can't discount the fact that that is a huge draw for tourism in this city.
You know, well, first off, I just want to say, Brian, I love it when you come on, because you always drop such great I went to French for a moment. Such great words. I really want to have, this is where creatives come and we're a little bit crazy. Can we make that a homegrown t-shirt?
Yes, we can.
You guys got to snip that audio out and start the show with it every day.
Exactly. Making merch for us, man. But I just watched a very small documentary about the person who created the shopping mall, and how our current shopping mall is different from what he wanted. And what he was originally thinking of is having a place that was more like what we're talking about, some mixed stuff. And also that he was looking to create an open space, a space where people could gather, where community could form.
Well, and one thing, and I don't want to cast creatives as irresponsible, as not pragmatic. I think that creatives are actually what create our culture. Everything that you drive, every article of clothing you wear, everything, the buildings you live in, creatives make these things. That the world really, as it exists right now, would not be what it is without creatives. Mm-hmm. And just like on Tuesday, this upcoming Tuesday, Ashlawn Opera is coming to do a free concert at X. That's about the highest of culture that I can think of. And
rock
that
on.
Is what we aspire to. And I love that Ashlawn Opera sees what is happening there and wants to join with it and help build it. The Virginia Film Festival is showing a film next Friday, Beach Blanket Bingo, a free showing. So this is the university. And a very esteemed festival, the Virginia Film Festival, sees the value in creativity coming and changing a space. We had Look 3 came, brought New York photographers with shelling oysters so when we say creatives, this isn't just some dude with a spray can on a wall.
Right.
This is the pinnacle of, I mean, you're doing Shakespeare. I mean, this is what our culture is made of, and this is the things that we value. And there is an economic basis behind all of it.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing that creates our culture besides creatives is subcultures, right? I mean,
right.
Think of what our culture owes to gay subculture. Think of what it owes to African-American subculture. Think of what it owes to Appalachian subculture. This is where culture comes from. It percolates
right.
up. And let's not crush the subcultures that exist in the SIA. Let's foster them with creative development, economic development, not drop another mixed-use monstrosity right on top of it and squelch it.
And that's what things like the Highline Park and places like that, I mean, they totally revolutionized Hell's Kitchen. And perhaps sometimes to the detriment of some of the folks who live there. I think that, again, is a concern. Okay, what happens when you have a home run? Okay?
Yeah.
So, again, creativity, strategy. Okay, how do we do this the right way? And let's all come to the table and support it. Support it with everything that we've got. If we've got time, if we've got money, if we've got energy, if we've got ideas. And it's a place, and that's the opportunity now because it's raw.
Right.
And all those ideas can be applied, and we have an open door. That's my job. My job is to keep the door open to ideas. And who wants to come and really make this not just, you know, okay, it's another, you know, building or it's another whatever, but a place that the whole country can come and go like, look what happened there. Actually, I mean, the downtown mall is an example of that. It's one of the very few downtown malls that has been successful in this country. And that is to the credit of this community who supported it. And that community means the people who live here. It means the civic people. It means the people working in private industry. Everybody has to come together because that's the what is the legacy for our kids. It's a legacy for ourselves. So, you know, to me, that's why I decided not to make movies this year. I want to make community, and I want to get that intention and strategy in place. And there's only so much I can do, but there's also so much that anybody who's listening to this program can do. And to me, that's the good work to be done.
Larry, Brian, thank you so much. It was wonderful having you, and we will definitely have you again. How about that? We can make that promise.
Thank you. And thank you guys, because you guys are part of what creates this cultural community and our future as well.
Aw, they like us.
And it's the preponderance of words that you're putting out
that
makes that possible. So thank you guys.
Yes!
I want my belief.
Boom! There was just talk about the small ball. It was a little short hop, and I was going for it, and Larry just picked it up, threw it home. More sports metaphors on this Homegrown than you will find for the entire rest of the month. Thank you very much, guys. Let's talk about some of the artistic things that are going on in our artistic town this week. Currently running until August 28th, it's the American Shakespeare Center summer season. Still going. 12th Night in King Lear by Shakespeare and the modern musical Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson. Check those out. Also currently running until July 15th, talking about the Ashlawn Highland Opera. Mozart's Così fan tutte, at the Paramount Theater. Also, to go across the mountain, currently running Verona, Virginia, Oak Grove Theater, Summer Theater Under the Stars. They're playing My Favorite Year, the musical. Currently running right now at UVA, if you want to stay closer to home, until July 16th, Souvenir, a Fantasia on the Life of Florence Foster Jenkins. It's a funny, heartfelt tale about a wealthy, would-be opera diva. It's part of the Heritage Theater Festival going on again at UVA. And what Leslie was talking about at the beginning of the show, Cleopatra the Seventh, running until July 18th at Guerrilla Theater. From July 16th and 17th, coming up this next weekend, the Moppintown Film Festival, the Jefferson School African American Heritage Center. Go to sevopodcast.com, look up Homegrown, see our past episode where we talked to the presenter of the Moppintown Film Festival to find out what that's about. July 16th, the Big Blue Door Improv Night at Seaville Coffee. July 19th, the Virginia Film Festival's VFF at the Violent Crown series. Nuts, a feature-length documentary about Dr. John Romulus Brinkley, an eccentric genius, erstwhile snake oil salesman who built an empire in Depression-era America with a million-watt radio station and dubious medical procedures. Check that out. July 19th, Poetry and Fiction Night at Rapunzel's Cafe, Coffee and Books in Lovingston. July 22nd, Open Mic Night at Jefferson School. This afternoon, let's talk about just a little bit of the musical options available to us This afternoon, jazz front and center with Bobby Reed's Igniter and Velvet People Collective at the Ante Room. Tonight, King Golden Banshee Celtic Jam at the Tin Whistle Irish Pub. July 12th, Uncovered. It's our favorite singer-songwriter open mic Uncovered, hosted with Brady Earnhardt at Escafe. This month's Uncovered, oh my goodness, Jenna Matthew, Justin Stoner, Jamie Dyer, Peyton Tochterman, and Ben Bauer. Check it out. Tuesday at Escafe. July 13th, Phil West at Heritage on Main. July 14th, it's Scuffletown at the Market at Grellin. The Michael Ellswick Gathering at Fellini's. The David Tewksbury Band at Pro Renata Farm Brewery. And July 15th, Baba Seth at Fridays After Five with Born Crooked. I can strike something off of my bucket list. I got to announce Baba Seth. July 15th, we are Star Children and LB Brass and the Judy Chops at Jefferson Theater. Don't want to miss that unless you're going to see Jackass Flats with Gallatin Canyon and J.J. Von Breezen at the Southern Cafe and Music Hall. Or maybe Michael Clem and Rusty Spidell at Adventure Farm and Vineyard. And of course, July 15th, also the Randy Johnston Trio at the Bebedero. DJ Tulo at Tavern on the Janes and the Velvet People Collective at Blue Moon Diner. July 16th, it's Davis, Don Levy, and Friends at the Tin Whistle Irish Pub. Lord Nelson at the Batesville Market, Seaville Jazz Congregation at the Bebedero, and DJ Groovematic at Rapture. Of course, every Sunday, it's Travis Elliott at Rapture. Every Monday, the Singer-Songwriter Night at the Local. Every Tuesday, the Traditional Irish Session at the Tin Whistle Irish Pub. On Wednesdays, you got the Open Mic Night at Pro Renata Farm Brewery, Bob Benetta at Cafe Katura, the Mike Rosensky and Jeff Decker Quartet at Miller's, and Jim Wave at the Blue Moon Diner, playing the country so nice. Even my cold, cold heart breaks down and starts to weep. Every Thursday, it's the Woolen Writers Revival, hosted by Will Thomas Reed and Brian Craddock at Firefly. And if that's not enough for you, head on down to Miller's on Thursday for the John Dearth Quintet, because every once in a while, you just got to come down to Dearth. And that's just some of the artistic town things in our wonderful artistic town. Okay, so here we are with our next guest, or maybe our first guest, or maybe our second guest. Who knows?
We have no idea what we're doing.
Welcome to the show from Live Arts, and from Live, specifically from Live Arts Summer Programs, Daniel Neal and Ryan Sheehy. How are you guys?
Well, thank you
good.
For having us.
Yeah.
Thank you for coming. And also, I think we might just have Bree Luck here, the current... What is a provisional artistic director of Live Arts? Is that the official title right now?
Interim. Jeez, Clinton. Interim.
The interim artistic director. Not the interim provisional artistic director. Not the temporary interim short-time provisional artistic director of Live Arts.
Actually, it's the interim managing artistic director of Live Arts, which, of course, spells out IMAD.
But everyone who knows you knows that that's not you, Bree. So it's okay.
Good.
So how's the summer going for you guys?
It's awesome. We're having a ball. We're about a week away from opening. You know, we've only been rehearsing for just over a month. So it's been fast and furious, but we're ready to get the show in front of an audience. Right, Ryan?
Yep, totally.
And tell people what this show is that's coming up.
Well, it's a Gershwin classic with like a comedy twist and new era. It takes place in the 1920s, and Daniel is a wealthy playboy, and I'm playing Billy Bendix, who is a tomboy, a bootlegger, trying to make a living, and it's a cute romance with tons of plot twists and funny bits and... It's a really good time.
Yep, all these crazy characters come together, and nice work if you can get it.
Excellent. So what's it been like applying yourselves to something from the 20s?
It's exciting because while it's set in the 20s and there's a lot of 20s style to it, there's also many, many modern twists. You know, Ryan, if your character was really in the 20s, I don't know if she'd be acting the same way. There's a lot of dimension to all of the characters, and there's a lot of depth, and we fight, I think, maybe some of the traditional archetypes of that era.
Yeah, and the 20s is always a fun time. I know that when, you know, you learn about it in school, you learn about the flappers and the the fun parties and the Jazz Age and Gatsby. So it's fun to take on those personas and really live that life.
Cool. So is it the original production that you're doing, is it, or is it an adapted production?
So that's a really good question. So all of the songs are written by George and Ira Gershwin, but the show actually didn't premiere on Broadway until 2012. So the book writer, Joe DiPietro, wrote his own story inspired by some material from the 1920s and then took all of these classic Gershwin tunes and put them in there.
Wow. So are these tunes the tunes that were originally in the show, or is it like a compilation of Gershwin greatest hits?
So it's a little bit of both. So there was no real original show. All of these songs come from a myriad of different Gershwin shows.
I get
some
it.
Of them hit, some of them not so much. So Joe took the best from each of those shows and put them together into this one.
Nice, nice. Nice. So best of all worlds right there.
Well, and who doesn't love Gershwin? Like, I mean, how can you... There's no bad Gershwin.
What? There's no bad Gershwin?
No.
You really want to go on the record for that?
The great appropriator? I will go on the record for that. There's no bad Gershwin.
Just, really?
Yeah, because he was the great appropriator.
Just like, one phrase. Bess, you is my woman now.
Well, yeah, but I don't like Porgy and Bess, but you know what I'm saying.
See, that's what I'm...
But there's no... I don't like it. I'm not saying it's bad. I'm just saying I don't like
Bess,
it.
Bess, you is my woman now.
Okay, first of all, my name is not Bess, and you need to take a step back.
See?
Okay.
See?
Can I just...
See?
Can I just say that?
No bad Gershwin, please. So, have you guys... So, is this show separate? So, Live Arts has been running camps for teens and also for kids younger than teens in the summer. Is this show part of the camps? Is it separate from the camps? What has your guys' been relationship with the camps?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Ryan and I, actually, the first time we met was during a Live Arts camp. This production, though, is separate. This is part of Live Arts. This is a main stage production, but it's unique because it is all kids. Well, teens, I should say. And then, yes, there are also lots of summer camps going on. Brian, you're working more with those.
So how is that unique? Because I thought Live Arts had done teen shows before. He says, lobbing you.
They have.
Live Arts
has done some incredible, incredible productions that feature really cool teen roles. But Bree, correct me if I'm wrong. I think this is the first Live Arts production, main stage production, that consists entirely of teenagers. Is that true?
No, there have been other shows that consisted entirely of teenagers. The difference is that this show was really incorporated into the, incorporated into the summer education program, in that the set will be used for another show that will take place just after this one closes, which is a camp show, and that's Seussical the Musical. And many of the teams that are working on them overlap. So it sort of rolls into it. It's not precisely a camp, but there were some educational components to this show as well. I think you guys had a comedy workshop, mm-hmm. and it seems like you had some other educational components.
A musical theater history lesson.
That's right, a musical theater history lesson. And who came in to do that?
Professor Chapel, the retiring head of UVA's theater department.
Bob Chapel, that's right.
Oh, I love Bob.
We love Bob.
We do. We love Bob.
Happy retirement, Bob.
So when does the show go up?
We open Friday, July 15th.
Wow, that's soon. Are you guys ready?
I don't know. No, we are. We're very excited about it.
So what has been the biggest challenge that you've had working on a show with all teenagers, being teenagers yourself?
Well, I think that... You know, teens, we have our own worlds and our own, I wouldn't want to say drama, but...
No, you can say drama. You can say drama. It's okay.
Just go ahead.
But it's so much fun, I think, being with people your own age, and there's a little less pressure as far as trying to, you know, maybe impress the older people in a cast if you're working with adults. And there's also a lot of pressure put on us to prove that we can be just as good as adults and that we can put on a show that's great and that the community will be impressed with and proud of.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that because I was wondering just that, not whether or not you guys are up to snuff, but I was wondering whether or not you had something to say to people who had that concern, who hear the idea, teen show and think, oh, well, that's something that I can not put on my list.
Absolutely. And I think one of the things that I think sets this production apart is it draws teens from all over the Central Virginia area. You know, in addition to all the local high schools, we have teens from several colleges. And I think that wide pool of talent is really what has made this production so special.
Okay, so you're saying people from college. So I need to know what the age ranges are here.
14 to 20.
A 20-year-old is a teenager now?
Oh, yes.
Oh, she said that emphatically, didn't she?
Really?
I think
we might argue
that happened in rehearsal.
I think we might argue that some 40-year-olds are teenagers.
Well, yes, but that's definitely a deeper conversation than we have time for today. And, you know, we don't have the psychiatrist on call, so.
Bree, stop. I know you've always hated me. You've always, always hated me.
I love you, Clinton. One of the advantages to having teens is that they have great stamina. These kids are working so hard, and the dance numbers in this are really some of the finest that I've seen. And you guys have been working 6 days a week, and your rehearsals are, what, 4 hours a night?
4 or 5 hours, yeah.
4 to 5 hours a night, 6 days a week. And that's an intense schedule. And I don't know that a lot of grown-ups could handle that in the same way that you guys do.
So is this what you guys are? Would you guys consider yourselves to be theater kids, as it were? I mean, is this
I am absolutely a theater kid.
Yeah, completely. I think that both of us have grown up around this and have grown up knowing that this was what we wanted to do.
Well, but I also say that that's a privilege, I think, to be able to say that. And it's a testament to the opportunities that Live Arts provides, you know, to be able to do such awesome theater with awesome other people who are also theater kids during the summer is a really, really cool thing that we're all very lucky to have.
Well said, well said. Amen.
So what else is going on at the with the camps and the productions at Live Arts this summer? As she gets her very large piece of paper. You guys can't see this. It's huge, and it's yellow.
It's true. It's huge. It's almost as big as Ryan is here. So we've had a number of full-day camps for kids ages 8 to 17, really. We've had a musical theater showcase camp, which is a two-week musical theater camp that's a classic Live Arts camp. We have a comedy camp. We actually have two sessions of this comedy camp. It's a one-week camp. It's very, very popular, where kids are learning all the, well, not all, but many of the basics of comedy, comedy improv, vaudeville, movement, all sorts of stuff. We have a Playmakers Intensive. That's the camp that's...
Can you teach comedy? is that really something that can be taught?
I think you could teach comedy.
I think Clinton teaches comedy daily. Some of us don't pay attention.
There are certain elements that you can teach. I mean, so much is about being confident and really believing in your voice. And that works both for drama and for comedy. And that's really what those camps are about, is giving kids different tools to get there, to gain that confidence. But in that sense, I do think you can teach comedy. Right now, we have this camp that's called the Playmakers Intensive. And so that's a two-week camp. And the kids are working in the first week, and they're writing their own one-act plays. And then next week, they will produce them. That's a really fun camp that they're doing. And it's great. Right now, I was walking through the rehearsal room, and I saw all these kids with their notebooks out in little groups, their heads all pressed together, and they're... you know, in these very intense conversations. And then we have a page-to-stage one-act workshop, and that offers kids the opportunity to put together a whole play in 1 week that's a non-musical, so that kids who are interested in theater but maybe can't take on the challenges of a musical, couldn't do the whole rehearsal period for that, can do this one-week camp too. And that's a lot of fun as well. Those are for the kids ages 8 to 17.
So do all of the camps have a performance aspect at the end of them?
They do all have a performance aspect. They're process-oriented camps. They're really about the day-to-day growth that happens and the relationships that come from that and doing the work. But each camp culminates with a presentation for family and friends.
So this is sounds like a lot of time, a lot of effort, a lot of planning, and a lot of ranging. I know that many theaters have an educational component to them because, let's be honest, for one reason, it's a way of bringing in income. Can you talk about what Live Arts' relationship is to this educational, and specifically to the summer, because it's something that's been happening for a while.
It has been happening for a while. Mike Long is the education director, and that is his job, is creating this whole robust education program. So the program has actually grown quite a bit this summer with the two productions, and we've added a couple more camps this summer, too. So it's grown a lot. And it all really...
Brian, Daniel, you guys are veterans of this experience. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And, you know, in addition to all of the incredible opportunities during the summer, Live Arts education program continues throughout the entire school year. And not only does it continue for kids like us through the school year, but there's also adult programs throughout the year as well.
Which Daniel has tried to sneak into many times.
Well, he shouldn't be sneaking into, right? Because he's like, he's right there.
What, did he get carted at the door or something?
He did.
Nope, I'm sorry.
Well, considering
this tall to ride this ride.
Considering the 20-year-olds are now teenagers, I mean, what do you have to be in order to be
What's
in the adult program? Do you have to have your own coke problem and be smoking two packs a day?
Right.
This is what's waiting for you in the world of art, by the way.
This.
They're like waiting for us. Pass the blow.
We do have adult classes, though, some great adult classes at both the beginner level and the experience level that that are offered. Usually there's an adult beginner class and then an advanced class each quarter. And then sometimes we have adult dance classes as well. We have tap classes that take place most of the year. And they're a lot of fun.
Cool. We're going to take a moment to do a radio-type thingy. I want everyone who's listening to us at home, turn around and look at a clock. You got it? You see it? Is it in your viewpoints? Okay, that's how many minutes it is past the hour that you're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. If you're just joining us, we are here with our denizens from Live Arts, Daniel Neal, and...
Ryan
Sheehy. Oh, see, I knew it was going to blow it. Daniel Neal, Ryan Sheehy, and the artistic, interesting, interim, managing, temporary, just flew in from Jupiter director.
My God. Can you get her title right just once? Just get her title right just
what
once.
What makes you think that I'm trying to?
I know you're not trying to. That's the problem.
Brie Luck.
I think I may add that Jupiter part to my email signature.
I think you should.
Well,
go for some of those NASA grants. That's what I'm talking about.
Well, and that's only a little different from the title he usually gives people, which is Grand Poobah.
No, that's not a title that I give people. That's the title people have given themselves.
I'm not sure about that.
Only you can know for sure. Go to SevoPodcast.com and listen to past shows. Tell us which one of us is right.
Yes, the winner gets a prize.
So, you guys have been dancing, you guys have been doing comedy, you guys have been singing, you guys have been dealing with the classic works of a man who we can argue about his value, but certainly cannot be denied to be one of the premier people in terms of American popular music, certainly in terms of American musical theater. What has been your favorite aspect?
A really good. It's a hard one because it's all so cool in so many different ways, and I think part of that is what makes musical theater so special, and particularly this show. You know, there aren't a lot of roles in musical theater where you get to act and sing and be funny at such a crazy high level. So I think while it's kind of a cheat, I think being able to do everything is my favorite part of it.
Yeah, I think for me, the music is so iconic, and Gershwin is so iconic as well. And just to be able, especially for me, Billy has these amazing ballads and long solos that, you know, everyone knows the words to I've grown up listening to with my parents and my grandparents, and just to be able to put those on stage and put those into a new context because of how funny and off the wall this show is, I think is my favorite part about doing this show and especially playing this role.
Yeah, to jump on the material again, specifically for you, Ryan, have you, when dealing with Billy, have you had any moments where you felt the disconnect of years, where you've said, oh, wow, this is something that's very 20s that I, as a young woman in 2016, just don't connect with at all?
I think that's definitely been part of it and definitely been a challenge to really step into her shoes. And because obviously some of the things she would be struggling with, I could never even dream of having to deal with in 2016 or even the 21st century. But I think that that's part of what makes it fun, to discover the parts of someone that you don't connect with and that you have to discover for yourself. And I think that she's so interesting, and that just being such a leading lady is something that I aspire to be, being a strong and powerful, you know, role model or person in my life.
Okay, can I just say how awesome it is to hear a young actor like to do work?
Yeah.
That is so, so awesome.
That won't last.
Stop it! Don't jinx her like that. No, it will last. That's what she's going to do. That's what she's going to do. For the rest of the time she is doing theater, she is going to be happy to do the work.
I hope so. Daniel and I like to do the good work all the time.
Well done, well done. So if there's a person listening to us who is on the fence about whether or not to go see Nice Work, if you can get it, what would you say to them to tip them over?
You could also sing to them.
Oh, no, you don't want to hear that. Come see the show. Come see the show. Trust me, it'll be much better there than right now. I would say that you owe it to yourself to see what all the youth in Charlottesville have been doing all summer. Come see the awesome, awesome work that they put in, the good work Ryan was talking about, and see how hard they've been working. Let them prove to you how great they are.
Blam! There you go. Daniel, Ryan, Bree, thank you very much. Give us once more the where and when for Nice Work if you can get it.
Nice Work if you can get it opens next Friday, July 15th at Live Arts, and runs every Wednesday through Sunday all the way until July 31st.
No reason to miss it. No reason to diss it. Thank you guys very much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
All right. We want to thank our guests, Larry Gerritsen and Brian Weimer, talking about the disappearing affordable arts studio space downtown. And we want to thank Bree Luck, Ryan Sheehy, and Daniel Neal for talking about Nice Work if you can get it at Live Arts. Please go see that show. It sounds really fun. And please get involved. Make sure that artists have space to do what they need to do in Charlottesville. Thank you so much. This has been a great show. We will see you next week.
You've been listening to Homegrown on 94.7 WPVC LP Charlottesville. You can contact the show on Facebook by searching Homegrown Charlottesville. Be sure to tune in again next Sunday at 10 for Homegrown, only on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville.